This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Climate change, health care, equal pay for women, trade, Afghanistan, immigration, and impeachment of President Trump are many of the issues debated between Democratic presidential candidates Wednesday night in the U.S. State of Michigan. Like the first round of the debates, frontrunner former Vice President Joe Biden was a target. His voting record as a U.S. senator was called into question, and he was asked whether or not he regretted voting opposite policies that are most common to the current Democratic platform. It gets tougher to appear on the stage at the third debate 6 weeks from now. To qualify, then, candidates must have 130,000 campaign contributors and at least 2% support in four polls. Only seven of this week's 20 debaters have already met the third debate criteria. The South Korean military detained a North Korean soldier who crossed the heavily fortified demilitarized zone and separates the two countries. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff said on Thursday the soldier expressed his intention to defect to South Korea. The unidentified active soldier was first detected by thermal imaging equipment moving south near the river late on Wednesday, and South Korean troops took him into custody just before midnight. Also on Wednesday, the South Korean military recovered a body near the DMZ and suspect to be that of a North Korean civilian. That's according to a spokesman for South Korea's defense ministry on Thursday. This is VOA News. Germany has rejected the U.S. call to join an international mission to protect maritime traffic and the Strait of Hormuz. The United States had asked Germany to join France, Britain, and a mission to secure shipping through the strait, the narrow maritime passage through which international tankers actually go through. The spokesman there said that Germany will not take part in the sea mission presented and planned by the United States. German finance minister and vice chancellor Olaf Scholz said that it was important to avoid a military escalation in the Gulf region. And he said that a U.S.-led mission carried the risk of being dragged into an even deeper conflict. The United States on Wednesday imposed sanctions on Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, effectively slamming the door on the country's top diplomat, AP's Ed Donahue.
Zarif has been critical in the past of U.S. sanctions. He spoke in Tehran last year.
The U.S. administration appears to believe that imposing illegal draconian sanctions on Iran will bring about such pain to our nation that it will force us to submit to its will.
The highly unusual action of penalizing the top diplomat of another nation comes a month after President Trump placed sanctions on Iran's supreme leader. It's part of an escalating campaign to pressure Iran over its nuclear program. Zarif says on Twitter, sanctions have no effect on him or his family. He has no property or interest outside of Iran. Ed Donahue, Washington.
The Trump administration is hailing this week's trade talks with China and Shanghai as a positive step, AP's Charles de la Desma reports.
Spokeswoman Stephanie Grisham says the U.S.-China meetings, aimed at ending a tariff war over trade and technology, are expected to resume in Washington in September. In a statement from officials, the Chinese confirmed their commitment to President Donald Trump to buy more U.S. agricultural exports, something Trump had publicly cast doubt on. Economists had said quick breakthroughs were unlikely because the two governments still face the same disagreements over China's technology policy and trade surplus. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The U.S. Central Bank decided to cut its benchmark federal funds rate by 0.25 point. Also, a tally of House Democrats now finds that nearly half support an impeachment inquiry against President Trump. Find more at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Thursday, August 1st. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Mozambique's government will sign a peace agreement today with RENAMO rebels.
I believe now Mozambique is more closer to reach two peace agreements, because as we can see, the rebels are tired to be all this time in the bush. So a number of guerrillas running over the weapons, saying they just want to go back home.
That's veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpaivai. Sudan's military authorities suspend schools following killings of high school students. 14 people were reported wounded Wednesday in Liberia following clashes between opposition and ruling party supporters. And the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives has condemned what she calls the grave evil of slavery.
Our delegation has been humbled by what we have seen this week. Being here has been a transformative experience for all of us, even if you had been here before.
The Speaker Nancy Pelosi speaking Wednesday in Ghana's capital, Accra. The Ebola crisis in the DRC enters its second year as fears of the virus spreading grow. And Botswana's test and treat HIV strategy yields results. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Mozambique's government and former RENAMO rebels are expected to sign a peace agreement today, Thursday, to finally end years of conflict. The day comes as RENAMO forces this week began disarming and turning in their weapons in preparation for reintegration into the National Army and Police. Veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpaivai says he believes Mozambique is ready for lasting peace because RENAMO rebels are tired of being in the bush.
We must be aware that the two previous peace agreements failed, one in 1999 and the other one in 2014. This agreement, which must be signed this Thursday, also comes out after there are some images on the Mozambican TV with soldiers in disarms handing over the weapon of the rebel movement. There are a lot of expectations after. I must underline that the National Assembly of Mozambique just passed some days ago a general amnesty on all war crimes during the last crisis between the government forces and the rebels. Everybody are expecting that at the end of the day, Mozambique could finally reach true peace.
Mario, this agreement is the effort of the late RENAMO leader, Afonso Dhlakama. According to it, RENAMO forces are supposed to be integrated into the army of Mozambique and also the police force. Do you think that this country is on the path to peace, or RENAMO might come back again to fight?
I believe now Mozambique is more closer to reach two peace agreements, because as we can see, the rebels are tired to be all this time in the bush. So a number of guerrillas running over the weapons saying they just want to go back home. The problem was in reality that until now, there was not confirmed that some officials and some mid-level guerrilla officials were not guaranteed to reintegrate in the army. This problem seems to be sorted out now, and I believe this has been a major stumbling block during the last negotiations. On the other hand, there was also a lot of efforts from mediators from Europe, which has been helping the Mozambican peace process since the beginning, long years ago. And I really believe this time they could also reach a peace agreement. As I said before, the general amnesty of war crimes for both sides was also an important step to promote reconciliation.
In 2 months' time, Mozambique will have general elections, and it's coming also before Pope Francis visits Mozambique.
In reality, the current Mozambican president and his government, they want to show the world they really want a true peace climate. As we know, Mozambique is facing also a huge economic crisis, especially in connection with the well-known case of adding debt with the involvement of the former finance minister, Manuel Chang, now arrested in South Africa. This crisis also affects a lot. President uses in the National Assembly this Wednesday that this economic crisis affects Mozambique a lot, not only in terms of the support from foreign countries concerning the budget, and also affected the attraction of direct foreign investment. So they really need to have a peace and to have a fair and free elections in a view to attract foreign investors and promote economic development in a climate of political stability.
Mario, thank you very much for speaking with us again.
Thank you very much, Jay.
That was veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpavai. He was speaking with us from the Angolan capital, Luanda, 400 years after the first ship of enslaved Africans sailed to America. The Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, condemned what she calls the grave evil of slavery in a speech Wednesday to Ghana's parliament. Pelosi told Ghanaian lawmakers the visit to Ghana has been transformative for her and the other members of the delegation. Stacey Nutt reports from Accra.
After arriving Sunday in Ghana with a group including members of the U.S. Congressional Black Caucus, the first female speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, and the other lawmakers toured Elmina Castle and visited the Door of No Return at Cape Coast Castle, both of which were slave forts where people were shipped in chains to the New World. Sitting next to Mike Okwei, Ghana's Speaker of the Parliament, Pelosi was the first U.S. Speaker of the House to address Ghana's parliament. She told the House that she and her colleagues' visit was about acknowledging the past while also looking to the future. Pelosi and other lawmakers, including Congresswoman Ilhan Omar and Congressman John Lewis, earlier met with Ghana's president, Nana Akufo-Addo. Ghana has marked 2019 as the year of return to encourage people of African descent to visit the nation. Pelosi told the chamber that visiting the two sites was overwhelming, saying they mark the beginning of the journey of the African-American experience.
Our delegation has been humbled by what we have seen this week. At Elmina Castle, we saw the dungeons where thousands grotesquely tortured. At Cape Coast Castle, we stood before the Door of No Return, where countless millions caught their last glimpse of Africa before they were shipped to a life of enslavement. Being here has been a transformative experience for all of us, even if you had been here before.
Pelosi also spoke about the relationship between the two nations, thanking Ghana for its work in global security, especially its contribution to United Nations peacekeeping missions. The visit has had a strong emphasis on economic and trade ties between the two nations, which Pelosi also addressed in her speech, acknowledging the efforts of the Congressional Black Caucus.
America is firmly committed to economic progress in Ghana, a commitment enshrined and advanced over the course of many years through the Millennium Challenge Partnership and in the African Growth and Opportunities Act. Together, our governments must continue to support smart developmental strategies that spur sustainable economic growth and lift up all families in Ghana and throughout Africa.
For Adjoa Safo, Deputy Majority Leader of Ghana's Parliament and the Chair of the Female Caucus, Pelosi's visit was pivotal. As one of the few women in Parliament, Safo said the speech was right on point.
I believe that with her enormous experience in politics and having risen from the local level up to Speaker of the United States, her visit is very historical and inspiring for most of us as women.
Safo said the two nations had a good relationship, which should be further strengthened. It was the sense of partnership Pelosi was emphasizing during the visit, along with promoting additional economic and trade ties between the two nations, while also underscoring the need to combat climate change, push for female empowerment, and provide healthcare equality. Stacey Knott, reporting for VOA News, Accra.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, August 1st. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour In Liberia, at least 14 people were reported wounded Wednesday following clashes between opposition and ruling party supporters as both sides awaited the results of senatorial and legislative by-elections. Partisans of the four collaborating opposition political parties were engaged in what they call pre-victory celebration when they said they were attacked by ruling party supporters. Benunai Yuri is chair of the collaborating opposition political parties.
The partisans of all four of the collaborating political parties were celebrating. The riot police came and they quarantined the front area of the party headquarters, and our people were merrymaking and celebrating. When some thugs from the CDC headquarters came and started throwing stones, fighting our partisans to the point where approximately 11 persons got wounded. And then the police also intervened and started shooting live bullets and tear gas. In fact, they shot three canisters of tear gas.
Were your partisans violent during the celebration?
How can we be violent at our own headquarters? We at our headquarters celebrating, and people came outside our headquarters and started throwing stones and attacking us. Aren't we entitled to celebrate at our party headquarters?
What were you celebrating, Senor?
Victory. Because we believe from all the calculations we have done that our candidates were successful, you know, but this isn't nothing strange in Liberia. The CDC government have celebrated from the minute election got over in many instances, and the Liberian people didn't attack them. What's wrong with Liberians celebrating now? It's reaching the point in Liberia that we can't even comprehend why would a leader allow this to happen to his people.
Benunai Yuri is chair of the collaborating opposition political parties of Liberia. He was speaking with reporter Moses Gaziewu in Monrovia. Meanwhile, the ruling Coalition for Democratic Change, the CDC, has denied it instigated the violence. Chairman Mulba Malu says opposition supporters first attacked ruling coalition supporters.
I would like to categorically reject that insinuation. Seditions are very level-bodied. Seditions are peaceful people. We've been victimized by some of the worst provocations by individuals in the opposition, especially Mr. Yuri, who is known for instigating violence, threatening the rule of law, threatening to undermine peace and stability. We are always confined at our party premises, within the perimeters of our party premises. We have absolutely no reason to be at any other political party headquarters. What Mr. Yuri is not revealing to you is he has sent men at the headquarters of the CDC to unleash violence and banditry on our partisans. And I can show you proof of partisans of our party being victims of internal bloodbath. People, even one of our partisans' hand was broken. Another guy was wounded in the eye. Someone was also hurt by the broken bottle, allegedly upon the instructions of Mr. Benunai Yuri. And what is surprising is I was at the party premises when these men deployed unleashing violence and mayhem.
They did come to your party headquarters.
Everything I'm explaining to you took place graphically at the headquarters of the CDC in Congo Town.
Mulba Malu is chair of Liberia's ruling Coalition for Democratic Change. He was speaking with reporter Moses Gaziewu in Monrovia. Sudan's military authorities have suspended all schools following the killing Monday of six people, including four high school students in the city of El Obeid. The African Union mediator for Sudan has called for a speedy trial of those responsible. The head of the ruling Transitional Military Council, Lieutenant General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, says the council is waiting for the truth about how the shooting started. Reporter Namba Mohideen is in Khartoum, explains.
The decision of suspension of the schools came after school students protested all over the country, condemning the killing of the protesters and the school students in El Obeid. So right now, there is a decision that schools, universities, and any educational institution, it will be postponed, and the opening, it will be after the Eid.
It's not too clear now in terms of how many of these students were killed. There are different accounts. Have the authorities been able to say exactly how many students were killed?
Yes, authorities said that five school students and two citizens were killed in Al Obeid, and then demonstrations erupted in the country condemning the killing of the protesters.
Do we know now who is responsible or how the shooting began?
Due to eyewitnesses, school students were protesting against the electricity shortages, fuel and delay of school buses. So they were protesting against the bad services in Al Ubayyid, and they were shot and attacked by RSF troops due to social media activists. But TMC in a press conference said that RSF troops are not responsible of the killing and blamed Shadow troops, which is the former regime militias, about attacking and killing the protesters. But after people were so angry and protested for 2 days all over the country and blocked the streets with barricades and burned tires in a very obvious escalatory procedures against TMC, TMC yesterday on Wednesday stated that RSF individuals are the people who attacked and killed the protesters.
In the meantime, do you think these developments will have an impact on the conclusion of the formation of the transitional government?
Actually, yes. This attack and other violent attacks happened earlier this month and June already had impact on the political agreement and the constitutional agreement. The protesters refused any talks with the TMC. Yesterday on Wednesday, Communist Party stopped the talks with the TMC, as opposition also stopped the talks. So it will definitely affect the final agreement, as right now the street is against any talks with the TMC, and they think that if opposition resume talks with the TMC, it will be a very crackdown in the public opinion, and a lot of protesters will erupt in the country.
Naba, thank you very much again for speaking with us.
Thank you, James.
That was reporter Naba Mohiuddin speaking with us from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. As the Ebola epidemic in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo enters its second year, experts from the World Health Organization are voicing concern about the growing risk of the virus spreading to neighboring countries. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Fears that the deadly Ebola virus could spread to Congo's 9 neighboring countries are growing, with the death of the second person confirmed to have had the disease in Goma, a city of more than 1 million people. Goma, the capital of conflict-ridden North Kivu province, borders Rwanda and is DRC's gateway to the rest of the world. Uganda has had 3 imported cases of Ebola. While it has successfully contained the spread of the disease, WHO experts warn of the potential dangers should the virus enter South Sudan, which is a particularly vulnerable, unstable country. This is the 10th Ebola outbreak over the past 4 decades in the DRC. The executive director of WHO Emergencies, Michael Ryan, finds this current one presents unprecedented challenges. Ryan notes, previous outbreaks were generally small, self-contained, and often confined to remote rural areas. This has changed. He says factors such as a conflict, forced migration, unsafe health facilities, and disease amplification are increasing the risks from emerging diseases.
So the risk of an individual disease emerging may not change, but the impact of those emergences are changing. And in that sense, it is a new normal, and we need to be ready. I put 80% of our high-impact epidemic responses are in fragile, conflict-affected, and vulnerable countries. So in about 30 countries around the world represent 80% of these high-impact epidemics.
Ryan says African countries need international assistance to help them strengthen their fragile health systems. Without this aid, he warns, Congo and other nations will have great difficulty in tackling future outbreaks of Ebola and other emerging diseases. The World Health Organization has deployed more than 700 international experts in the field. The UN agency says it is scaling up Ebola preparation measures in the neighboring countries, especially Burundi, Uganda, South Sudan, and Rwanda, which are most at risk. It says frontline health workers are being vaccinated against the disease. More Ebola treatment centers are being set up, and more than 3,000 health workers are screening people for the virus at major points of entry. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A test and treat HIV program is getting results in Botswana after the Southern African country recorded a decline in cases of the virus among participating communities. But the rate of the deadly virus remains among the highest in the world, according to a recent study by the Botswana Harvard AIDS Institute Partnership. Kundise Dube reports from Harberuni.
21-year-old Tlotlo Mwilwa was born with HIV and orphaned at age 10 after losing both parents to the virus that causes AIDS. But thanks to Botswana's well-developed anti-retroviral therapy program, Mwilwa remains healthy.
There are programs that are out there that are given to people who are HIV positive. What I can say about our government is that it is so supportive. They're always there to support us.
One such program, Test and Treat, showed increased viral suppression and a 30% reduction in new HIV infections among 15 communities in a study group. Test and Treat was set up in 2016 with the help from the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, PEPFAR, to treat all HIV patients regardless of their viral load. Dan Kron-Seleka of PEPFAR Botswana says a key aspect of the program's success is community health workers making sure that every HIV patient went for treatment.
And the sooner that people are put on treatment, the sooner that the virus is suppressed within their body, and they may not be able to pass on virus to others.
The New England Journal of Medicine in July published a study led by researchers from Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and the Botswana-Harvard AIDS Institute partnership. Richard Madlare of Botswana's National AIDS Coordinating Agency says the country is the world's third highest HIV prevalence, with one in four adults between 15 and 49 HIV positive.
We haven't won the war as yet. If you look at the cohort of our adolescent girls and young women, 40 new infections per week to us are far too high.
For HIV patients like Mwilwa, who was born before prevention of mother-to-child transmission efforts, Botswana's progress in the fight against AIDS gives hope for a future with healthy children.
I am not in a relationship. Absolutely. God is so going to bless me with a family.
Botswana aims to have 95% of those infected with HIV know their status, be on treatment, and achieve viral suppression by next year. Mqondisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of African news. Officials in the Democratic Republic of Congo say the person who was confirmed as the second case of Ebola in the city of Goma has died. The announcement was made Wednesday, a day after the latest case was first revealed. The case involved a man who traveled to Goma from a northeastern rural community in Ituri province. He was diagnosed a few days after arrival and was being treated at the Goma Ebola Treatment Center. Goma is home to more than a million people and lies directly on Congo's border with Rwanda, where tens of thousands are cross on foot daily. Earlier this month, a pastor tested positive and later died after arriving in Goma by bus, sparking fears that the disease could spread quickly through the densely populated city. Mozambique's government and former renowned rebels are expected to sign a peace agreement today, Thursday, to finally end years of conflict. The day comes as renowned forces this week began disarming and turning in their weapons in preparation for integration into the national army and police. Sudan's military authorities have suspended all schools following the killings Monday of six people, including four high school students in the city of El Obeid. The African Union mediator for Sudan has called for a speedy trial of those responsible. The head of the ruling Transitional Military Council, Lieutenant General Abdel Fattah El-Burhan, says the council is waiting for the truth about how the shootings started. That is it for this Thursday, August 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Greg Burns, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, thank you for listening to Border Crossings with Larry London. This month, Border Crossings is giving away a really cool Voice of America t-shirt. If you want to win one of these awesome shirts, all you have to do is make a song request for our show. I see it, I like it, I want it, I got it, yeah. Tune into Border Crossings at 1500 Universal Time every weekday in August for your chance to win.
They're still trying to figure out what are the specific policies from the White House.
VOA Asia, your daily digest of top Asia stories.
Beijing has especially hazardous levels of air pollution.
Blending American and Asian perspectives.
China is protecting wildlife.
Original reports and series, education, health, technology. Stories that mean something to your daily life. VOA Asia.